Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything that we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to discuss continuation of Chapter 5 of The Feminization of American Culture by Anne Douglas, written back in 1977, or at least published then, talking about the redirection or the rechanneling of American intellectual firepower into the study of history away from theology. And we'll pick it up with the second subtitle called The Antiquarians, History as Sentimentalism. It's on page 215 if you have the text. The Antiquarians, History as Sentimentalism. Again, we're talking about the rise of mass culture, which is feminine, consumerish, more passive, more what's on the menu that might amuse me today, and less rigorous. Douglas says, the collective output of the Romantic historians, even with its oppressive bias toward masculinity and force, that is, history as military history, constituted an undisputedly serious effort toward American self-realization. There were important reasons why antebellum America was, that's before Civil War, vitally receptive and suited to the Hegelian and post-Hegelian outlook. As we have seen, the new history represented the use and transformation of the structures of America's oldest intellectual tradition, Protestant theology, in the service of a modernizing time and change-conscious culture. Furthermore, the belief in progress so common in America, a belief based on enormous industrial and technological development, made palatable and even necessary the idea central to the historicism which Hegelian thinking inevitably created, that events occur uniquely and irredeemably in time. To put it another way, only a high degree of materialist optimism, such as America habitually suggested, could permit men to live without benefit of the notions of compensation inherent in older, non-Hegelian, and cyclical theories of history. America was a civilization whose rapid and apparently promising intellectual, economic, and social development necessitated the at least partial adoption of historicism. I have suggested that the Romantic historians, like so many of those who have come closest actually to dealing with our culture, were in part absorbed by the phenomena they attempted to analyze. They held the mirror to the fundamental impulse of their society. Inevitably, they themselves were also reflected and contained therein. Yet it is important to remember that Prescott, Motley, and Parkman immediately commanded European audiences. History was largely responsible for what share of intellectual respect America evoked abroad before 1850. So those abroad said we had no literature, but they did respect our historians. Immediately, from the outset, these are Prescott, Motley, and Parkman, three of the big seven she mentioned that we talked about last time. She said whatever portion of respect we could command, it came from these historians. History was largely responsible for what share of intellectual respect America evoked abroad before 1850, as opposed to letters, as was later the case with the novels of Hawthorne, Nathaniel Hawthorne, and the work of the Southwestern humorists. Foreigners interested in America were even quicker than the U.S. citizens to hear and listen to an authentic voice. They were alert to note when the ratio between propaganda and information shifted the critically essential degree. If the work of Bancroft, Prescott, Motley, and Parkman is imperialist, at times repellently so, it nonetheless represents a significant clue to a critique of a society which was itself absorbed in conquest. And the Romantic historians, as we have seen, intermittently sensed and expressed the corrosive and seeping ambiguity of American success, although they could present no alternative to the cult of progress. Others did try, if in vain, to find an alternative. The four major American historians were widely admired in their own time and since, although their work continued to appear and to be read throughout the latter half of the 19th century. The historical writing of which their work was the most significant outcome had passed its peak by 1850. Indeed, the proportion of histories or historical novels among bestsellers the percentage of historical material and the contents of the more popular magazines and reviews began to diminish in the 1840s. Just as critical exegesis, whose models were also largely German, that is, the historical interpretation of the Bible, the higher criticism or the new criticism, failed to take firm hold in the antebellum period, Romantic history enjoyed a rise and fall during the same time. Important historical work, like major biblical criticism, did not reestablish itself until several decades after the Civil War, and then in more scientific, more technical, and less synthesized form. So kind of the move from mythical to factual history, but history was of great importance in America from, say, 1700 to 1850. But then by 1840s, it was starting to drop off and not to return it in a slightly different form until a couple decades after the Civil War. And, of course, you have the rise of the Industrial Revolution. You have new sorts of tools for recording things like photography. Remember, the Civil War was recorded, who was it, Matthew Arnold, the photographer, took pictures? This does not mean, however, that history was not written in the U.S. between 1850 and 1875. Although fiction swept the American market as never before, histories and biographies continued to pour from the press. The period witnessed the rise of lyceums and libraries, many of them interested in the preservation of local history and monuments. The collection and publication of genealogies and the founding of magazines like the New England Historical and Genealogical Register and the New Englander. What had happened was not even the temporary demise of history, but the temporary defeat of one wing of the emerging historical profession by another. The triumph of sentimental, local, antiquarian, social, and loosely speaking, religious history, written mainly by clergymen and women, over romantic, national, prophetic, political, and secular history, produced principally by well-to-do amateurs. The earliest historical research in America had been done at the local level, if only because, as I've remarked, towns and states and sections were initially interested in history as a means of self-inflation and self-advertisement, which could justify their claim to a bigger piece of the new national pie. In other words, the historical impulse in early 19th century America, and remember, America's only formally established in 1789, or 1776, Constitution or the successful revolution, but it's been around for 100 to 200 years before that. And so after the revolution, they all want to claim they had a bigger stake than they actually might have, and that's spurred on in local recountings. In other words, the historical impulse in early 19th century America was as natural to those who felt unjustly neglected as to those necessarily involved in the problem of conspicuousness. The men and women who wrote local, antiquarian, or biographical history at this time were fascinated by the meaning of obscurity. The cliché they most frequently used to describe their motive was the phrase, to rescue from oblivion. To rescue from oblivion. They did not claim the title of historian, but referred modestly to themselves as those who filled, quote, the humble office of a compiler. They were anxious to find, quote, those minor points which have escaped the notice of historians, unquote, and, quote, the smaller matters of individual experience, which more pretentious historical narrative, in its stately march, could not step aside to notice. Forgotten local bits of history, in other words. The Chronicles discovered their mission in redeeming what was discounted as waste by imperialist Hegelian history, and in many ways their effort was potentially admirable and farsighted. The majority of what I will call the antiquarian efforts, which were under clerical and feminist auspices, or feminine auspices, reveal a justified anxiety among ministers and women that their society was as indifferent to their past as it was to their present. One writer, speaking on ministerial biography in the New Englander in 1854, urged New England towns to discover and publish the history of their former ministers and churches. He anxiously cites an example of neglect. Quote, there are large portions of the state, Connecticut, in which nothing has been done to rescue from oblivion the memories of the early ministers. Clerical commentators could be perfectly frank about the special importance of the past for them. whatever the past might actually be, it can function in the present as an emblem of changelessness and thus provide a corrective to a society obsessed with change. As one rather florid commentator wrote in 1859, block quote, "We idealize the past and recall in it the placid monolight, the placid moonlight of romance, set off in the form of imagination and seen through the haze of softening regrets and holy tears. Its domain, so sweetly peaceful, whence most of the evil has been eliminated and where all the good has been touched with consecration, contrasts with the turmoil and haste of the present." Reflecting on the past and its seeming but not actual tranquility in contrast to the present day, ministers wanted to dwell on the past, but the past which concerned them was hardly the one presented by contemporary romantic historians. They were often uninterested, occasionally hostile, before the supposedly heroic exploits of the colonial and revolutionary periods. Sylvester Judd lost his position as chaplain to the Maine legislature when he felt compelled to preach against the American Revolution. Noah Webster, despite his strong Federalist reverence for Washington, also found the Revolution morally disturbing. Penn was the only one of America's early heroes he praised unstintingly. In 1815, Worcester straightforwardly, if heretically, disavowed these archetypal American models of masculine endeavor, the Puritan fathers. He found them, quote, "a class of men assuming the most hostile attitude, brave in battle, but always in a state of alarm, anxiety, or hostility." Horace Bushnell took a similar view of his theological progenitors. In his depiction, they resembled titanic figures in a fresco by Michelangelo. They are imposing and inhuman. Quote, "They took hold of the iron pillars that held up the theological heavens and climbed and heaved in huge surges of might and kept their gross faculties in exercise. They looked upon the throne, they heard the thunder roll. They provided a grand, massive character for American religion, to which God now means to add the needed softer shades of feeling." Edwards A. Park was never able to love Jonathan Edwards, although he devoted the last decades of his life to a memoir of his famous ancestor. Park venerated Edwards, but he wished Edwards had been able to be, quote, "something more of a brother and something less of a champion," somewhat less of a champion. Champion suggests an overpowering figure, a combatant, and a winner. Devalued by his culture, the mid-19th century liberal clergyman evaded rather than courted comparison with his Whately predecessors. Equally important, he insisted that current historiography, in ignoring less conspicuous experience like his own, was perverting its task of record-keeping and record evaluation. The liberal minister was aware of the slight place his profession was accorded by contemporary historians. Park noted that, quote, "the name of a pastor is seldom mentioned by an historian." William Ellery Channing remarked that history, quote, "has not a place even in its margin for the minister and the schoolmistress." We have seen what short shrift Jared Sparks gave clergymen in his Library of American Biography. It was perhaps Sparks's neglect which spurred his friend William Sprague of Albany to compile his massive 9-volume Annals of the American Pulpit between 1857 and 1869. The titles of the two series are significantly inappropriate. Sparks's biographies, or lives, usually present studies of an entire place and period, while Sprague's Annals are actually a compilation of short biographical sketches which supply the reader with little historical background. Sprague can omit the background because of the growing disassociation between the mission of the minister and conventional historical action or importance. The minister was increasingly seen as belonging to what Horace Bushnell eloquently called the dead history of oblivion, and dead history consists of the deeds and people which live on in their unrecognized influence rather than in the articulated memories of their fellows. "Do the vegetable growths repine or sicken," Bushnell asks, "because they cannot remember the growths of the previous centuries? Is it not enough that the very soil that feeds them is fertilized by the waste of so many generations moldering in it?" Edwards A. Park explained with some point that, quote, the real unwritten history of the race is not in the main made up of war and diplomatic maneuvers, but of those domestic griefs which the pastor assuages and of those private joys which he hallows. The implicit assimilation of clerical and feminine history here under the rubric domestic and private is striking and understandable. Women, too, felt with justice that their story was both real and unwritten, both those in quotes. Middle-class women were by definition less responsible for America's industrializing present or its heroic past than their secular male peers. They had had their share, more than their share, some felt, of the democratic work of settlement. One feminist historian, writing for the radical reform periodical The Lily in 1853, quipped angrily that she was tired of hearing of the hardships of the Pilgrim Fathers had endured. The Pilgrim Mothers had suffered all the same trials, plus the Pilgrim Fathers. That's like that old quip about Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, like she did everything that he did, except backward and in heels. Women had had less than their share, however, in the elitist business of lawmaking and constitution composing. Feminine work has always been ahistorical by the definition of male historians. Raising children and keeping house have customarily been viewed as timeless routines, capable of only minor variations. In a country like America, whose historical identity rests on a short series of self-conscious crises, the exclusion of women from historical life of the culture is particularly acute. American history does not reach back into an irrecoverable past, hence it nowhere takes on in retrospect the aspect of process which interweaves it inexorably with social life. We have marble busts of all of our great leaders, original copies of all of our important documents. We even have photographs which cover a third of our entire span. Men keep public records. Women seldom figure in them, much less keep them. American history, by any comparative basis afforded in the Western world, is an extraordinarily recorded affair, and hence an extraordinarily masculine affair. In America, history has functioned as a kind of literary test, or literacy test, which women automatically fail. Women who undertook the writing of history at mid-century did so with a revisionist aim, whether acknowledged or not. Elizabeth Ellett, E-L-L-E-T, a New Yorker and a poet, dedicated her considerable skills to the reinterpretation of the American past. She was well aware that there existed an, quote, abundance of materials for the masculine history of action, and yet little for the feminine history of feeling. Yet she determined to redress the balance. In her most important work, The Women of the American Revolution, published in three volumes between 1848 and 1850, Ellett tried to turn her readers from their preoccupation with the Revolution's leading spirits, the Founding Fathers, to a concern with the Founding Mothers, who provided the nurture and the domestic sanctuary of what love and civil liberty which afterwards kindled into flame and shed light on the world. When women wrote historical novels, they did so to express discreetly veiled hostility to the very history they were apparently extolling. I have already discussed works like Eliza B. Lee's Naomi as protests against the ministry, but they were perhaps more importantly protests against a peculiar definition of American history. The mission of the heroine in these novels is to free the hero from history. She rescues him paradoxically from the historical novel, which she transmutes to a domestic tale. Naomi and her loyal lover eventually desert the Puritan faith and the Puritan community, which persecutes those belonging to their Quaker persuasion. They marry and go off into a Sylvan idyll. Sylvan means wood, like Pennsylvania. Penn's Woods, Sylvan idyll. The book ends precisely and appropriately when we pass out of the prison of male chronicles into the domain of unrecorded feminine grace and family life. It is, of course, a convention of the novel that it closes with a dismissal of its characters into their private lives, where they will no longer be subjected to the reader's scrutiny, but this convention has double force in a book like Naomi. The author does not so much drop the historical lifeline as cut it. Her characters have gone into a realm where history cannot follow them. Catherine Sedgwick's historical work is equally ambivalent. Occasional protests from America's male critics, who felt a woman could not deal adequately with history or government, apparently found an echo in Sedgwick's understandably confused conscience. In Hope Leslie, 1827, a romance set in 17th century New England, Sedgwick's high-spirited heroine represents benign feminine anarchy wreaking charming havoc with official records. As she defies the stern edicts of Governor Winthrop and his peers, frees witches, and defends Indians, Hope Leslie suggests counter-history. She is an ex post facto protest against the masculine solidities of the past. In later books, Sedgwick evaded rather than subverted American history. She prefaces The Linwoods, 1835, a novel about the American Revolution, with an avowal that she has omitted any real consideration of the Revolution itself on the grounds that she is but, quote, a weak and unskilled woman. She tastefully substitutes for such analysis the delineation of several rather dull love affairs and a few fervent panegyrics on Washington's nobility of character. Only the heroine, Isabella Linwood, an impetuous patriot who continually regrets she is not a man and thus able to defend her country, suggests Sedgwick's frustration at her sex-determined exile from her own material. Notice how the feminist in 1970s describes it as her sex-determined exile. Today she would invariably have said gender-determined. They were more honest and more rigorous back then. Funny how those two things go together, don't they? By the later 1830s, Sedgwick had turned to thinly fictionalized domestic manuals and religious tracts. Her apostasy from history, even from subversive history, was little noted but immensely significant. Unable as a woman to find a perspective from which she could adequately treat the past, she turned her very real talents to a depiction of the pleasures and trials involved in running the modern household, and she took her large feminine following with her. Works like Sedgwick's Home, 1835, and Live and Let Live, 1837, result in embryo form, or represent in embryo form, the romance of domestic management, which would become the staple fare of the profoundly anti-historical women's magazines of the 20th century. In the generation of women authors which succeeded Sedgwick's, Harriet Beecher Stowe is the only major figure who could be said to have devoted her finest talents to the historical novel. It seems hardly accidental that the great vogue and success of female authors in what Fred Lewis Pate, P-A-T-T-E-E, has called the feminine 50s, coincided with the end of the dominance of historical fiction. The chosen noms de plume, pen names, of several of the most important of these authors suggest their anti-historical bias in its least constructive guise. These are the fake names they chose. Fanny Forrester, Fanny Fern, Grace Greenwood, not to mention Minnie Myrtle, Lily Larkspur, and later somewhat, Jenny June. Such names, flirting coyly with suggestions of vegetative process, are decorative advertisements of luxury items. Even while they flatter the author's femininity, they define it as superfluous. They are purely fictional. By such self-baptism, feminine authors become characters in their own sentimental effusions. Hothouse products. They are self-announced refugees from history. Just a couple more pages. This is a shorter sort of subsection we've got here. Literary women and liberal ministers joined in their antipathy to the military subjects which obsessed the Romantic historians. Many of them were pacifists, and their commitment to peace was clearly motivated by their dislike of masculine history, as well as by their hatred of violence. Pacifism was most prominent and viable in the period between 1815 and 1850, after the partial national disillusion with the catastrophe of the War of 1812, and before the heated and belligerent sectionalism which preceded the Civil War. Pacifism, unlike temperance, never had the official support of the major Protestant churches. It was launched in 1809 by a layman, David Lowe Dodge. L-O-W. Yet from its inception, the American Peace Society numbered a very high percentage of clergymen among its members and many women among its supporters. American Peace Society. One of the movement's historians estimates that a third of its initial supporters were in the ministry. Another scholar stresses that in 1828, the Peace Societies drew more adherents from the ministry, and especially the Unitarian clergy, than from any other profession. I think of the clergy protesting war in the 60s, that would be that type. By 1852, when the movement was in definite decline, it was a clerical concern limited to New England. Of its 307 life members, 168 lived in Massachusetts, and 93 were clergymen. Women were always active and eager in the pacifist cause. Where we have records for any given peace society, they reveal significant feminine presence. At Portsmouth in 1826, the group included 18 men and 17 women. Women were more likely, however, to evince their concern by less direct and conspicuous means. They could urge their minister to join the American Peace Society or to preach at least once a year on the subject of pacifism, and many did so. Most of the ladies' magazines of the day were avowedly and almost automatically in favor of non-belligerence. In the Ladies' Magazine of 1836, Sarah Hale had applauded the formation of the Boston Ladies' Peace Society. The Ladies' Wreath, a magazine devoted to literature, industry, and religion, edited by Mrs. S.T. Martin, M-A-R-T-Y-N, opened with a spirited attack against the tendencies of war. The Ladies' Album also editorialized indignantly and frequently on the evils of war, quote-unquote. Protestant ministers, unlike Protestant women, had taken an acknowledged and respected role in the American Revolution. 36 years after the struggle for independence, however, Noah Worcester, a Unitarian minister, himself a veteran of the Revolution, but destined to become the single most important figure in the early peace movement, denounced military glory in his one-man pacifist organ, The Friend of Peace, as absolutely unchristian, not to say unclerical. He exclaimed that a fighting minister at this day would be regarded as a madman. Worcester was frank from the start of his anti-war career on his alignment with feminine principles. He outspokenly sought the support of women, promising any future feminine adherents, quote, by 30 years of faithful and united exertion on the part of the females of Christendom, war might lose all its fascinating charms and be regarded by the next generation with more abhorrence than the people of today look on the gladiatorial combats of Rome. The view Worcester took and dramatized of war and his attacks on it was the minute and essentially domestic one that television, whose advent represented the apotheosis of social history, enables us to hold today. He was skillful at the close-up picture in which besieged towns become groups of families and soldiers become men, husbands, and fathers. For him, there was no such thing as military history. There was only the outrage of humanitarian values. Under the nom de plume of Philo Pacificus, Worcester described, quote, the horrors of Napoleon's campaign in Russia, unquote, in 1815. He felt that the reader is only diverted from the true issue by the customary encomium on the bravery of fighting men and the glories of victories. The idiots who call our military heroes. The point about war for Worcester lay in civilian consequences rather than in military actions. He directs us characteristically not to the battlefield, but to the sidelines, where the greatest and least deserved suffering is taking place. On one side was an old man, just expiring. On the other, an infant, whose feeble cries, the mother, worn down with grief, was endeavoring to hush. His concern is with the innocent victims, the women, children, and elderly, who can only be martyrs in the masculine arenas of conflict and aggression. In 1816, Worcester's friend and admirer, William Ellery Channing, voiced his protest against the exaltation of the hero with his, quote, love of excitement, his, quote, passion for superiority, for triumph, for power. Channing was perfectly conscious of what his demand, like Worcester's ex post facto reporting of Napoleon's Russian siege, implied. A new history. Let the records of past ages be explored, Channing urged, to rescue from oblivion not the wasteful conqueror, but the benefactors to the human race engaged in philanthropy rather than destruction. Those women who joined peace societies or urged their ministers to join shared many of Worcester's preoccupations. They too deflected military into social history. They too were concerned less with the actions than with the effects of war, and particularly with the effects which touched family and feminine life. An anonymous lady pacifist in the Ladies' Album explained that the female portions of society are the greater sufferers in war. Theirs is a domestic life. War breaks up the domestic circle. It calls the husband, the father, the brother, and the lover from the endearments of home to the field of carnage. One of the most popular novels of the Civil War, The Gates Ajar by Elizabeth Stuart Phelps, a novel which reached and touched thousands of female readers, never recorded a battle scene or presented a soldier. The author's concern, in her words, was with, quote, the women, the helpless, outnumbering, unconsulted women, they whom war trampled down without a choice or protest, unquote. Phelps's story focused on Mary Cabot, a young and insignificant girl in a small Massachusetts town who was overwhelmed by grief at the loss of an idolized brother in combat. Mary finally accepts the war and all its dreadful consequences only by denying its reality. Following an obvious process of compensation, she ignores earthly existence to focus on a heavenly land where family felicity is exaggerated into eternity. Domestic peace, a world of women and womanly cares, is seen to be the abiding order, not the aggressive and senseless militarism of men. For Phelps, as for Worcester, heaven, like history itself, is a civilian affair, a matter of individuals and their tastes and needs. So there you have, and that's the end of the section. Ministers and women, more pacifist, more into domestic stuff, more into feelings and emotions, and moving away from military history and thinking that stuff has been overlooked, and let's bring out this other side of it. Look at the people who aren't talked to, the marginalized, alienated voices that we never hear from. You know, it's kind of how they would phrase it. It's not wrong so far as it went then, but this could easily be politicized today when their side had more power. But I think pretty good stuff. We understand what's going on there. Anyway, that's another segment of Chapter 5. And I think next time we'll conclude Chapter 5 next time. Anyway, thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.